Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anababe, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabe sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we are fortunate enough to have our good friend Adam Kinzinger back on the podcast, first time in 2022. So first of all, Happy New Year, Congressman.
Yeah, thanks. Back at you. And by the way, I like doing the podcast. The thing I don't like is now I can't listen to it today because I don't like hearing myself. So, you know, I got to find a different podcast for my run today.
Yeah, I am sorry. I do apologize for that. Okay, well, let's start off this way before we get into other stuff. Tell us who is Ray Epps. Tell me the Ray Epps story.
It's funny because so this started to pop up, oh man, I'd say kind of November. And it was part of this whole, you know, conspiracy that it's really the FBI behind January 6th. And there was a guy, and we probably, you know, without people realizing, they probably saw the video. He was standing around outside on January 5th. And he had a MAGA hat on, and he was like, you know, we're going into the Capitol, into the Capitol. And then some people started chanting Fed, Fed, Fed. Well, that was now the huge evidence, and he was on video a few other times. I don't know a ton. I don't know everything about him because he's not a high-level player. The committee has interviewed him. But basically, he was put on the FBI's most wanted list. They had a conversation, from what I understand, and they took him off. The guy basically, as far as I know, did not go into the Capitol, break the law, and it was just kind of a, okay, now he's going back to his life. And the reason it's so important to take this on is he has been shown to be, quote-unquote, a federal agent. And now what they do, so Tucker and all these people, they do things like they intermittently change, you know, federal agent with confidential informant. By the way, those are very different things. But according to Ray Epps' own testimony, he's had no involvement with law enforcement whatsoever. And we have to put that out there to discredit because that has been the kind of quote-unquote hard evidence that started with Marjorie Taylor Greene, spread to Tucker Carlson, and of course was quote-unquote mainstream by Ted Cruz Tuesday in his conversation.
Yeah, so Ted Cruz is asking, who is Ray Epps? Is that why the committee decided to release the information that they talked to Epps and that there was no evidence whatsoever? He had no ties to – is that why the statement went out?
Yeah,
blow it up. Yeah.
Basically, that's a moment when you look and you go, look, we've got to address this head on. I've been watching the whole Ray Epps scandal since it started. And so, you know, I personally thought this is something we should address early. I've come to believe that, you know, conspiracy theories, you don't wait till they're big. You get them in their infancy because they basically grow into quote unquote known fact, you know, very quickly on the blogosphere. And we have to look at this differently than we did 10 or 20 years ago.
So you've been asking on Twitter that various other political figures who have toyed around with this, do you still think that Ray Epps is a federal agent? Because you're trying to hold him accountable for that.
That's right. I mean, you know, if you're going to go out and you know, quote unquote, just ask questions. Okay, that's one thing. If you're going to ask questions implying that Ray Epps is a federal agent, why was Ray Epps taken off the Most Wanted poster? Let me, first off, no matter what you say about the FBI, I don't think they're dumb enough to put their own agent on a wanted poster for months. But, you know, okay, let's put that aside. I think it's important for whether you're running for office or whether you're, you know, an influencer, if you start throwing crap like this out, you have to be held accountable to it. You have to answer. You can circular argument with me all you want on Twitter. The fact of the matter is, you made the claim that Ray Epps is a federal agent, and it was proof that the FBI incited January 6th, not to mention the fact that, you know, you have to think very low of your voters to think that, you know, one man can basically incite an entire insurrection. That's an FBI agent, you know, not, and it can't be the fault of the president who led up to the whole conspiracy theory and then incited them from the pulpit. So yeah, they have to be held accountable to that. And, you know, they do a great job, Tucker especially, of when one conspiracy he pushes is disproven, he just moves on to the next one. And it's just, you know, it's people are overwhelmed with lies and information. They just choose instead to trust one person because there's so much conflicting information out there. It's hard to do your own work.
I just want to stick with this for a moment. Philip Bump at the Washington Post has a piece up. You know, another January 6th conspiracy theory suffers a reality-inflicted blow. And he writes, measured in Fox News airtime, there is perhaps no January 6th conspiracy theory more popular than the idea that federal agents helped spur the violence that overwhelmed the Capitol on January 6, 2021. And within that particular theory, no individual has received more attention than Ray Epps, an Arizona man who has been identified as the person encouraging a crowd supporting President Trump on January 5th to enter the Capitol the following day and who appeared near the scene of the first barrier breach. To Tucker Carlson and his followers, including members of the House and Senate, that Epps was never arrested is a strong indicator that he was a federal agent who was at the scene specifically to gin up evidence. Here's how Senator Ted Cruz pressed the case in a hearing Tuesday afternoon, asking questions of an FBI representative, who is Ray Epps. FBI official said, I'm aware of the individual. I don't have the specific background. And then Cruz goes, well, there are a lot of people who are understandably very concerned about Mr. Epps. So then the committee issues that basically says, we've talked to him, we've taken his testimony, he's not. So how long had you had that information? I guess I'm getting at that you guys have a lot of stuff that we don't yet know about, right? I mean, yeah. You've known about Epps actually for some time now, right?
Yeah, and look, I'll just be clear. I think we should have put the information out earlier because, again, I, you know, as somebody that watches this, and it's really an advantage that Liz and I have on the committee, is the ability to see kind of, we live in different realities, right? And so we can see the stuff that starts bubbling early on. And, but yeah, I was interviewed back in November. It was a kind of a informal interview, we'll call it. And you know, it was clear that according to his own admission, this guy was really a bit player, no more of a player than the other 25,000 or whoever people that weren't arrested that were there. I mean, boy, if you took, you know, and this is kind of the response now that they've been caught is saying, well, he said to go into the Capitol. And, you know, that's what the president said, go into the Capitol and you impeached him over it. Well, it's very different when you're the president. You create a case leading up to January 6th, then you incite from the pulpit, then you tweet. You know, we could go on and on. It's very different than somebody caught up in the emotion of the moment. And at no point have I said or anybody said, quite honestly, that all the 20-some thousand people at January 6th should be arrested. We recognize that the vast majority were simply, you know, following through on their First Amendment right. The difference is when you breach, destroy, and try to disrupt the legal counting of votes that is a constitutional-driven thing, that's when you cross the line.
So let's talk about this crisis of accountability, though. And I know it's something that your committee is going to have to deal with. We have hundreds of people who had believed the big lie. You know, many of them, I think, sincerely believe the big lie, who went into the Capitol, and many of them have now been charged. And yet none of the instigators or the people who perpetrated the lie have yet been held accountable. There is a disparity there. How do we address that You know, you undoubtedly have, you know, seen that quote. I used it in my newsletter from Abraham Lincoln. You know, must I shoot a simple-minded soldier boy who deserts while I must not touch a hair of the wily agitator who induces him to desert? Right. I mean, this is kind of where we're at now.
It's a great point. And, you know, it's been a frustration from what is DOJ doing? They have the law enforcement capability. Obviously, Congress can't arrest anybody. We can't file criminal charges. We can get information. But here's a big thing to consider. So I do think, you know, the DOJ has done a good job of those they have in custody basically pressing about as max of the case as they can against them. But there was an interesting thing that's happened, which is after January 6th, you know, we heard about all these people that were arrested that had remorse, you know, sad about what they did, got caught up in you know, the violence and everything. But what you do is you built around them in the last year a media ecosystem convincing each one of these people, for instance, in jail, that what they did was actually heroic. Keep in mind, you know, on the one hand, the conspiracy is the FBI did this. On the other hand, what they did was very heroic and patriotic. When you convince people in jail that they are actually, you know, standard bearers for conservatism and for the American Constitution, that is going to take away any incentive to cooperate with DOJ. And that's what DOJ has seen, is all of a sudden a collapse in cooperation by these 700, because now they would be turning the back on the Constitution of the United States. That's an important point to remember, is this coddling ecosystem that reinforces to these folks that they are actually heroes. And of course, even though they're in jail, they have the same access to the news and talk shows that we do.
So give me a sense of how the committee is going based on the kind of evidence and information you have already gotten. I mean, we know that some of the people who are refusing to testify and cooperate, but based on what you already have, how confident are you that you're going to be able to present a complete and compelling picture of who did what and knew what when?
Look, I'm convinced that if the investigation ended, we could present that compelling picture.
Okay? Today. Okay.
Yeah, today. The problem is, you know, is it going to be enough to convince 30% of the country? Probably not, because, I don't know if there is anything that can convince certain folks. But what I think is just as important, and obviously as the days go on with this investigation, we'll have more proof to back up narratives, not just one witness, maybe multiple witnesses, et cetera. But what's more important to me, although I wish it was different, is not even so much, okay, we're going to give the narrative to these people and hope they change their mind. It's that when their kids are in school in 5 or 10 years, those kids have the truth. And they can look and be like, hey, mom and dad, did you believe this stuff? And mom and dad would have to lie and say, oh, no, I never believed it. That's insane. That's what I think the role of the committee is making sure that we interdict the conspiracy cycle. You know, your podcast, I think it was Tuesday, about Civil War.
Yeah.
But we interdict that Civil War cycle and change that. That is the important point of this committee. But I certainly hope those 30% or whatever it is can see the facts and are convinced.
Well, you think that the intent is also to come out, though, with tangible recommendations, number one, on perhaps legislation to Trump-proof the system from the kind of coup that we saw, or potential coup that we saw. And then number two, you know, whether or not there is legal accountability for, say, the former president. Let's ask, first of all, you know, about legislation. How confident are you that Congress might be able to Trump-proof the next presidential election?
I'm not confident at all. I mean, you know, I wish I was. And that is a stated goal of the committee, is to, you know, have legislative recommendations. The problem I see is, you know, the Democrats are focused on their voting rights acts, which, you know, we can argue, we can debate those. There's merits to some of them, not merits to other parts of it. But none of that would have done anything for January 6th. None of that will interdict the cycle in 2024. That is the Electoral Count Act. I think things like clarifying the role of the vice president, clarifying that, you know, if the ballots, for instance, are stolen, the, you know, the original ballots, that doesn't throw us into a constitutional crisis. That's how you can, in the short term, interdict 2024. In the long term, man, we've got to, and I don't know the answer to this, we've got to focus on proofing how we count ballots and proofing, you know, I don't even think it's the how, because I think we're doing it fine, but making sure that there is confidence in that.
So circling back to the question of the Trump and accountability, we don't know what the Department of Justice is going to do, but some of the things that your colleague Liz Cheney has said publicly certainly have implied that there might be some interest in asking whether or not there might have been some dereliction of of official duties or some other legal way in which Donald Trump could be held accountable. Will that be part of the committee's final deliberations and recommendations?
I think certainly if we have information that we think, and again, obviously, but it just bears repeating, we can't enforce that. But if we have information that we think is important for DOJ, absolutely. I think we can just kind of take a step back to about 20,000 feet and say, there's no doubt Trump had a dereliction of duty. The question is, was it criminal? And I think the key point to that, you know, for 3 hours, he basically did nothing but watch television while the insurrection was happening. I would argue that that is a violation of his oath to defend the Constitution of the United States. I would argue that in the best case scenario, that is incompetence, or that is, you know, he's just he's frozen with indecision. In the worst case scenario, he obviously knew this was coming. So that would be the worst case scenario. I'm not leveling the accusation yet. And hoped it succeeded. That would be the difference. The first scenario and second would probably be the difference between criminal, you know, liability with that versus just this guy violated his oath. And but there's no doubt Donald Trump violated his oath. And I think he did that the second he started questioning publicly on Twitter and otherwise the legitimacy of an election, because he undermined that basic contract in democracy that has to exist. The far left and far right, which were actually the same people anyway, but you know, the right and left, they have to agree on one thing. That's it. One thing, that their vote counts and that the results are accurate. That's all you have to agree on. Everything else can be handled in the political realm.
So let's talk about your colleague, Jim Jordan, who initially indicated that he was going to cooperate with the committee. He's no stranger to congressional investigations, now saying he's not. And his lawyers are raising questions about the constitutionality of your committee's push for his testimony, because he should be completely exempt and immune from any proceedings involving, how does it read in the Constitution, you know, the business of Congress. So your thoughts on Jim Jordan saying he's not going to cooperate with the body of which he's a member?
Yeah, I mean, look, on the without going into the into the constitutional part in a sec, but on the broader point, I mean, this is a guy that has been at the helm of so many congressional investigations. He recognizes the role of Congress in investigating legitimate issues because he's done it. He knows better. And, you know, if you truly believe in the institution of Congress, and I don't think he does, if you truly believe in the institution, you recognize that even if you disagree with what a committee is doing, the fact that it passed and it was formed makes it a legitimate inquiry of the American people. So he obviously has contempt for Congress. That is important to note when probably more than likely Republicans take the majority and Kevin McCarthy will be forced to make him some, you know, guy, some dude. And he tries to do the same thing. On the constitutional question, we've got all the lawyers, which I am not, looking into this, because there is legitimate questions about issues of speech and debate, about what Congress can compel of its own members. But we think, and you know, if there is a path to compel testimony, certainly we will do that, because look, the American people have a right to know. If Jim Jordan has nothing to hide, come in and tell us he has nothing to hide. Prove it.
What is the status of Mike Pence's cooperation with the committee?
So it's, you know, I've read or heard kind of the accounts in the media that he doesn't want to cooperate. I don't know the veracity or the truth of those. His staff is obviously very cooperative. I don't want to go into specific names, but they've been providing a lot of information, a lot of stuff that leads to other threads to pull. Because look, I mean, if I'm Mike Pence, I'm looking and saying, history could actually adjudicate his role on January 6th quite well. Right. He should want that out there. If the guy actually does intend to run for president someday, I got to tell you, this whole insurrection business is not going to age well in the long term. And so I certainly hope he's not pulling back on his cooperation. I'm sure we're going to know that probably more in the next week or two.
So your committee will be having televised public hearings. Should we expect to learn anything that we don't know now? Are there going to be any surprises? Will there be any moments that you think might actually change the sort of political stasis we're in over January 6th?
Yeah, I think I would compare what might happen at these committees to Liz Cheney's reading the text out loud, you know, kind mm-hmm. of revelations. I mean, I don't know if there's ever going to be a moment where we get a Donald Trump handwritten memo that we need to overthrow the, you know, the goodwill of the United States people. But I think when you see behind the scenes, the level of planning, the discussions that were happening, quite honestly, you know, the broadness of the discussions of people like Sean Hannity with folks in the White House, that's going to be pretty compelling and shocking to people. Will it change somebody's mind that says, no matter what is presented to me, I already have my outcome? Probably not. But I think the biggest thing we have to keep in mind is we can be depressed about the state of the Republican Party, which I certainly am. But when you still have 60, 65, 70% of the American people, which is way too low, but saying the election was legitimate, that 70% is enough of a bulwark. There you go. Mm-hmm. Enough of a bulwark to defend future elections. Now, if you go to violence and all that kind of stuff, obviously it's different. But I think we should sometimes celebrate that number and say, you know, the audience isn't necessarily the people that will never believe. The audience is those that are going to go turn out and vote and, you know, would never stand for another insurrection.
So I've been, you know, following some of the interviews and the discussions that you had, and you tell me whether I'm misreading this, okay? But mm-hmm. it strikes me that you, like a lot of us, have been going through this process of trying to figure out what the hell happened to us.
Yeah.
How did we get here? And I can tell you're kind of working it through. You know, you're talking about, I mean, because the reality is that this Republican Party that we see right now didn't just flip in the last few years. It's been building for a long time. And I know you're going back and thinking, okay, how long was this going on? What did I miss? Who is responsible for all of this? Is that a fair reading of what's going on with you now?
It's really fair. Here's my theory, and it could be wrong, but I think there's some certain inflection points. People talk a lot generically about the Tea Party movement. I'm less of an attacker of the Tea Party from 2010 to 2012. I think 2010 to 2012, I mean, I went to a Tea Party rally. It had 10,000 people that in Chicago. That was basically pissed off Republicans. Okay. Mm-hmm. After the election, after we took the majority, the Tea Party's dwindled to maybe 200 people and then eventually 50 and 10, right? So this was the hardcore of the hardcore, the people that had been rejected from kind of mainstream conservatism that basically took on the moniker of Tea Party. Here's an example. I never once, ever in my campaign in 2010, did I promise to not raise the debt limit. I never promised that. That's the stupidest mm-hmm. promise you can make. And yet in 2012, the Tea Party basically demanded fealty to never raising the debt limit. They started to get angrier. That's when you had people like the Freedom Club pop up that basically destroyed good chances to move conservative legislation because it wasn't conservative enough. And I think that combined with what started out as a somewhat legitimate grievance, we don't get a fair shake in the media. We didn't get a fair shake in the media. I would remind people, we still won 50% of elections somehow.
Yeah.
That was harnessed into things like, okay, the media hates us. The media is the devil. The media is the enemy. Over time, that builds into a whole new right-wing media ecosystem that reaffirms everything people believe. And I think then Donald Trump came along both as a symptom and as an accelerant. He was a symptom of the problem, but he accelerated crushing through norms, right? You know, a president can't do this. He did it. A president can't say this. He would say it. And I think, you know, I think there's historians probably that can point to other things prior to 2010. But from my involvement from 2010 on, those are key points.
No, I think that is fair. In fact, you probably could go even further back to that. I keep going back sometimes to things that Newt Gingrich did, the role of Sarah Palin. But you mentioned the Tea Party, and I've quoted this many, many times before, but I think it's just so apt. Is what Eric Hoffer said, that every cause begins as a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degenerates into a racket. Yeah. And I saw the same thing. The Tea Party starts off as kind of this populist movement, and by the time the next election cycle rolled around, it really had turned into something else. It had been taken over by the grifters, perpetual outrage industry. And
can I tell you a quick story about it too?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Finish.
No, go ahead.
Well, so right after I got elected, there's an intervening period between when you're elected and then obviously when you're sworn in, 3 months. And we have to go through, this is actually so stupid. We have to go through, orientation. That's not stupid. But I remember I get elected, taking a month off or so, I'm flying with the military. We take off, we fly a mission, I land, and my phone is just exploding, like a jillion text messages, everything. And basically what happened is, quote unquote, Tea Party leaders, I think it was that Jenny Beth Martin, they leaked all of the freshman class's phone numbers and email addresses on the internet and said, these guys are going to the quote unquote establishment orientation. They need to go to the Tea Party orientation. The Tea Party had set up their own orientation in DC. And now we had just, every Tom, Dick, and Harry calling us, telling us we are already traitors and we need to go to the Tea Party orientation, not the establishment orientation. That, even before I was sworn in, is when I said, okay, I'm done with the Tea Party. Bye-bye. It was insane. It's nuts. But they've been like that all the time.
Well, and Jenny Beth Martin was one of those people who sort of became the, face of the Tea Party movement, which was really, one of these, outrage grift organizations. And what I remember was that she was very, very outspokenly anti-Trump. But, when she got, a sense of which way the wind was blowing, she was one of the first not only to flip over to, pro-Trump, but one of the most, vigorous, one of the most feral Trumpists, because, obviously this was not really about ideas. So talk to me a little bit also. I saw you gave an interview where you talked about the Republican Party's trust crisis. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's two things, and I guess two T's, trust and truth. Mm-hmm. So the trust part, there is no trust, I think, between Republican leaders and the base. We've said, you've heard on your podcast 100 times, if you gave truth serum or CIA juice to everybody, that's an elected Republican, they would tell you, with the exception of a couple of weirdos probably, but they would tell you that Joe Biden won the election.
Sure.
But they are scared to death of their base. They don't trust that their base can handle the truth. The base doesn't trust what we're doing because obviously there's a motive behind anything we say. We've gone establishment or we've gone rogue. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The truth thing is, I think, even more detrimental to the future of this country. I was raised a Christian kid. I still have strong faith. And I don't go to Sunday school anymore because I'm a grown up. But, when I was a kid, go to Sunday school, it was the very first lesson every morning. And by the time you left, is tell the truth. The truth matters, even if the truth hurts. You steal something, go tell your parents you stole it. You're going to get punished, but it matters. We have gotten away from truth. And when you decline truth, when you go from, there's some gray areas and ways to interpret, but when you say things like the election is stolen and you corrode, the basic level of truth in this country, you cannot recover without something intervening on that cycle. And I think without base voters recognizing that they are being abused, they are being not just grifted, they're being thieved by, people that send out fundraising appeals like Rand Paul, give me $100 to fire Fauci. He has no control over firing Fauci. Yeah, what the hell is he talking about? Those are lies to profit. And I got to tell you, Charlie, if this country does fall to a civil war someday, and I used to never say that, and now I recognize it really is a possibility. If it happens, all these people that play war, they dress up, they have their cool guns, they've never seen violence in their life. all of them that are also on 6 or 7 different heart and blood pressure medications will be dead 2 weeks after the Civil War starts. Not because they got shot, because Walgreens doesn't carry their whatever they need now. And all of a sudden, war becomes real. And that's what happens when truth is destroyed. You know, you're talking Tuesday about what could be the impetus of that Civil War.
Yeah.
I was just thinking back to Kenosha. Let's say, and by the way, every Democratic governor waits a day long, too long to call out the guard. So listen, all Democratic governors, if you see a riot in place, call out the guard because they stop riots, right? And they just intimidate. Yeah. I've been part of it. But let's say Kenosha, the governor never would have called in the guard. Let's say that, you know, instead Kyle Rittenhouse, instead of shooting, let's say he gets shot and killed on the street. And then let's say there's no guard reaction, and now all of a sudden you have a Wisconsin militia or an Illinois militia that decides to show up to protect people like Kyle Rittenhouse. Well, we also know the left is arming up. Let's say they see this right-wing militia on the streets of Kenosha, and they show up. You can see right there how that is the start. Of course, every news agency is following it. That is the start of real violence. How do you back up from that? Joe Biden can stand out and say, hey, everybody needs to stand down. We can't have this violence. The right says, well, Joe Biden has an interest in that. You know, you can see how a trust deficit in this country, when leaders stand up and say, hey, guys, whoa, throttle back, all of a sudden that won't work anymore.
Well, and remember when that, I know that we've talked about this before, but I do keep coming back to that memory of that young man who showed up at one of the Charlie Kirk TPUSA events. Sure. And says, well, when do we start using our guns? When do we start shooting people? And, you know, Charlie Kirk said, well, no, you don't want to say that because that's bad messaging, not that it's bad actual action. But the problem is people are playing with these ideas. They play. There's a certain amount of cosplay going on here, but it will have real world implications if you keep saying the same thing and there are people with guns in dangerous situations. And you're referencing something I asked Barbara Walter on the podcast the other day, like, you know, what is the trigger? What is the spark? You know, some militia man or some cop, you know, fires their weapon at the Michigan State Capitol or on January 6th. It's easy for me to see how this happens and how it spins out of control. If you listen to the rhetoric, if you listen to the rising tide of hysteria, people have already been convinced that in fact it would be a patriotic or a noble thing to do this sort of thing. And at some point, you know, with all of the rhetoric, somebody's going to go, when do we start shooting?
Yep.
I'm sorry, it's going to happen.
You're right. And the impetus could happen from the second you order your Starbucks coffee till the time you finish it. You could go from being in a state of peace to a state of civil war. And it can happen like that. And I'll tell you, Charlie, I'm a big Second Amendment defender and supporter. I conceal carry wherever I go. I had a situation actually on the street in Milwaukee in North Avenue where I had to disarm a dude that was killing his girlfriend. I wasn't armed. And from that moment on, I've become a believer in it. And of course, then with my job today. But I don't, you know, I'll talk about it occasionally, like here. It's not something I got to, you know, lift my suit jacket up and show everybody I'm cool because I'm armed. I own an AR-15 and I don't put pictures anymore of myself with the AR-15, not because I'm against them. I'm not. But because too many people have taken their guns and used them as kind of a fetish, a gun fetish. Yeah. And the reality to me is as Second Amendment defenders, we should be the first people out saying, hey guys, walking into the Michigan State Capitol with an AR-15 is abusing your Second Amendment right. We have to be the ones out with reasonable gun measures to say, look, if you have to be 21 to buy a pistol in this country, you should have to be 21 at least to buy an AR-15. We should be coming to the table. And instead, what we're doing is flaunting this to people. And I got to tell you, you can call the left snowflakes or whatever. If I was on the other side of people flaunting AR-15s, by the way, you know, let's say the left starts doing that someday, I would be pretty worried about that as well. But instead, we just go out and flaunt our right. We're always trying to own. We're trying to spin up. And this doesn't end well. As a guy that's seen places torn with war, you know, we're not genetically immune to the same kind of factors.
I actually think that most gun owners would agree with you.
I do too.
Back in the midst of time when I was a talk show host, I remembered in Wisconsin, we had a couple of moments where We have, you know, open constitutional open carry here. And a couple of guys showed up at some farmer's market. I think it was in Appleton, Wisconsin, with AR-15 strapped to their backs. And, you know, to make a point. And I remember opening up the phone lines and just asking, what do you think of this? And overwhelmingly people, and I'm talking about people who are NRA members, people who are gun owners, people who are hunters and sportsmen, were saying, this is crazy. This is nuts. This is not helping our cause. This is frightening people. This is doing, you know. And so there's a gap in the debate, because I do think that there is this huge, and unfortunately, I would say a silent majority that's afraid or has been, I don't know, just, you know, induced to go along with all of this. So on this, before I move on, I keep coming back to, you know, you're talking about truth and the big lie and what happens and why Republican politicians are afraid to tell the truth. What do you make of this whole Senator Mike Rounds episode where he comes, guys from, you know, South Dakota. I mean, he's not one of the firebrands, you know. I don't know anything about the guy, except he's going, no, Donald Trump lost this election. No, he's, you know, and Trump rips him, you know, threatens him. Rounds isn't backing off. Even Mitch McConnell is now going, yeah, Mike Rounds is right. Are they like putting their toe in the water? What do you sense is happening here?
Yeah, I guess I think it's a little putting a toe in the water. It's been a freaking almost, you know, almost a year and a half since the election, a year and a quarter.
It's crazy.
I think they're getting sick of it, but, you know, and we should. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a million Twitter comments like, don't congratulate somebody for doing their job. I'm not. I wish Rounds would have said that earlier. But let's recognize when good things happen, like recognizing basic facts. But, you know, Donald Trump's reaction has nothing to do with Mike Rounds. He doesn't care about Mike Rounds. He has everything to do with trying to stem that cascade of people that have been desperate to say that are scared to death to say it, that might see that as some kind of a signal that they can tell their people the truth. Listen, if you're a leader in this country, you have to strip the title of leader if you're unwilling to tell people the truth. Yes, you've got to get elected. That's an important dance. It's a delicate dance I can't tell you how to do, but I can tell you that if you want to be a leader, your contract is, yes, get elected, yes, represent, but your contract with the American people is to tell them the truth. Because if you have leaders that don't tell the truth, you basically don't have anything.
So let me ask you about one other thing here. I'm looking at the Daily 202, the Washington Post newsletter put out by Olivier Knox. And the theme today is Republicans rally around a 2022 message, revenge. Impeach President Biden, boot House Democrats from committee assignments, subpoena top Democrats, go after Hunter Biden, put big tech out of business if they comply with the committee investigating the insurrection. It does seem that right now this is what Kevin McCarthy is pushing. They don't have a set of specific policies they'll enact, but the one thing that they're all in on promising is revenge.
Yeah.
Your thoughts about this, because this does seem to be what 2022 is going to be about now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. They've stirred anger. People are angry, and revenge is a palatable midterm, you know, in the minority wanting to take the majority. It's a good strategy. It'll work for them. Here's the problem. I mean, the problem is you've got to have some level of like, okay, what's right and wrong. You go to any country, let's say Central South America, you go to the former Russian Soviet republics, you know, any kind of struggling or failed democracy, what do you see? You always see new people come in and arrest and persecute the last administration. Now, some listener is going to say, isn't that what you're doing on January 6th? No, because on January 6th, we are defending right now the integrity of that peaceful transfer of power. But what you see in so many other countries, and as a Foreign Affairs Committee member, this is what I have to go talk to leaders of countries and try to walk them away from, is being mad that the prior president did something they didn't like, so they manufacture a reason to arrest them or to persecute their enemies. And it's why I was so outspoken when people would say things like, lock her up with Hillary, lock her up, lock her up. We are going down a bad path that you don't reverse from. And right now, we're trying to rest on the goodwill that Republicans can say that, but Democrats won't. Oh, I got to tell you, Democrats will adopt this at some point too if it's successful. And now you have both parties locking up prior administrations. You think you have crappy people in politics now, you just wait.
What's interesting is all this talk about impeaching Joe Biden next year from people like Ted Cruz. They're not even bothering to provide the reason at this point. It's just like, we're going to do it.
Yeah, and they want to impeach Joe Biden, but yet defending Donald Trump's role on January 6th. So it's no longer, and Ted Cruz, this, you know, quote unquote, master of the Constitution, it's no longer about inciting, you know, it's no longer about high crimes and misdemeanors. It's about political disagreements now. And, you know, look, that's why we've got to change the system. And a quick plug out in Utah, you know, Evan McMullen is running for Senate against Mike Lee, and he's got a shot to win out there. And for me, it's about, you know, disrupting a system to say, look, guys, we have to start attracting people in the middle, because I'm going to tell you, if you do that, Country First, you know, my movement, country1st.com, we're launching something at the end of the month called Primary First to convince people about the importance of voting in a primary. I won an election, a primary, a member primary, because some of the trade unions showed up and voted for me. Voting in a primary can work, because right now about 10% of the country is picking your congressional representation.
So just, I want to make it clear that we're not taking the Ted Cruz comments out of context here. You know, what Ted Cruz made the headlines when he predicted that the House would impeach Joe Biden, whether, and these were his words, whether it's justified or not, because Democrats weaponized impeachment when they accused Trump of wrongdoing. So, I mean, he's basically saying it's a partisan cudgel. They used it. We're going to use it again. So on a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being an absolute lock certainty, if, as we assume, Republicans take control of the House in 2023, what are the chances that they will impeach Joe Biden?
Okay, so here I have to give you two answers. One, what are the prospects that articles of impeachment will be introduced? 100. That'll happen.
Okay.
Marjorie Taylor Greene already introduced like day one on Joe Biden. Yeah,
that's easy.
What are the chance they will move an impeachment proceeding?
Actually,
I say 70.
It.
70 out of 100. Yeah.
So you don't think that all Republicans will in lockstep vote yes on that?
I mean, maybe they all will. Who knows what the issue is?
I have no confidence anymore at all.
I mean, I don't either.
I am just broken down.
Remember, Charlie, I'm like the numbers soothsayer.
I know.
Told you there'd be over 100.
No, I understand, and you were absolutely right about all of that. Well, Adam Kinzinger, good luck. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast again.
You bet. Anytime. Thanks for doing what you do.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anabae, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabae sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.